White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. It's Thursday night again, and I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Hadding Scott.
And we are here to bring you episode 29, which is chapter 24 in the International Jew. Before we get started, Hadding, I just think it would be proper to mention that we got amongst our financial gifts that we got over Christmas time and New Year's and so on. We have a supporter, Carl, who had a computer that he wanted to send to us. And so we said, all right. And turned out that you had the most interest in having the computer. So you have the computer, right?
Yes,
and
I do.
It has arrived. Yeah.
It's a super duper computer, too.
Yeah, it's a big one. It's quite a computer. So he paid to ship it to you. And we want to thank Carl for that.
Thank you, Carl.
Yes.
With this, I can take over the world.
Yes. Well, you said you're interested in maybe doing some videos or learning to make videos. So
yeah.
I think
okay.
you did make
yes,
some.
Yes.
I don't want to put you in the spot, but if you did make some, I'm sure they'd be very good ones. Okay. Change the subject. All right. Well, tonight's we're going to get right to it because we have a little over 4,000 words in this chapter. We want to complete it. And it's about money again, the high and low of Jewish money power. So it starts with a quote.
Quote from Protocol 20. You're on Shmuley.
All right. I'll do it. Economic crises were created by us for the Gentiles. Then it continues, the present issue of money does not coincide with the need per capita, and consequently, it cannot...
Yeah, wait, you left out some words there.
Well, maybe I don't. Maybe I lost them or something. That's
all
I have.
You left out some words.
What? The present issue of money...
No,
does
going
not...
back to the first sentence.
Oh, I guess I cut it off. What is it?
From
all I have.
Jump down to the next line.
Yeah, the present issue of money.
Yeah, you did. You jumped down to the next line. Do you have the words only by the withdrawal of money?
No. You better read that.
Okay, my text is different from yours then.
Well, I think maybe when I was copying it, I lost something. I don't know, because I think we have the same text.
Okay, well, okay. Shlomo will read this one then. Economic crises were created by us for the Gentiles only by the withdrawal of money from circulation. The present right. issue of money does not coincide with the need per capita, and consequently it cannot satisfy all the needs of the working classes. You know that gold currency was detrimental to the governments that accepted it, for it could not satisfy the requirements for money, since we took as much gold as possible out of circulation. That's Protocol 20.
Well, I would agree with that, too. I mean, basically, gold currency really is not sufficient for governments because there's a limited amount of it, and then they control it, and they took a lot out of circulation. So, therefore, people had to be borrowing from them. Isn't that what that amounts to?
Well, if your currency has to be backed by gold, then it's subject to manipulation by whoever possesses the gold.
Yeah, right. And they possess the gold, they're saying.
Adolf Hitler established a currency that was not backed with gold at all.
Yeah, and then I've fallen for this trap for many years that, oh, we want a gold-backed currency. Oh, it was
right.
terrible when they dropped us out of that. And, of course, it didn't work out well because it did create a lot of problems because of who was behind the whole thing.
Yeah.
The Jewish financiers, so, and maybe a few other non-Jewish ones, but mostly Jewish. And so therefore, we got this idea that gold is good, gold is good, where, and, you know, your book came out that you translated, that you
Gottfried
should...
Gottfried Feder's Manifesto.
Yeah, you should talk about that.
Which you can buy on Amazon.com, the Kindle version.
Yeah, it explains everything. It's all in good English. Yeah.
Well, right. It doesn't talk about gold that much, but gold backing for currency is really like the stone in stone soup. That's because people don't normally use the gold for trading and so forth. They use the paper for buying other things. And as long as the government is using that money to pay people and demanding it in as taxes, it's going to have value.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Government can say that the paper has value. Doesn't need the gold backing. Okay. So we're on chapter 24 here. The high and low of Jewish money power. Jewish high finance first touched the United States through the Rothschilds. Indeed, it may be said that the United States founded the Rothschild fortune. And, as so often occurs in the tale of Jewish riches, the fortune was founded in war. The first $20 million the Rothschilds ever had to speculate with was money paid for Hessian troops to fight against the American colonies. And I will say that there was a big moneylender's interest in the American Revolution because Britain already owed a lot of money from the French and Indian War. And George III, demonized as he is, was trying to pay down that debt. And then the American Revolution happened, and so much for that plan.
Okay.
Britain stayed in debt because...
No, I was going to say, he had to pay, or he thought he had to pay, Hesse Cassel, the princes there, for them to send their some of their army units over to America to help fight against the Patriots. Sure. Right, and that cost them a lot of money.
Yeah, that too. They made money that way also.
Yeah.
Since that first indirect connection with American affairs, the Rothschilds have often invaded the money affairs of the country, always by agents. None of the Rothschilds' sons thought it necessary to establish himself in the United States. Anselm remained in Frankfurt. Solomon chose Vienna. Nathan Meyer went to London. Charles established himself in Naples. And James represented the family in Paris. These were the five warlords of Europe for more than a generation, and their dynasty was continued by their successors. The first Jewish agent of the Rothschilds in the United States was August Belmont, who came to the United States in 1837 and was made chairman of the Democratic National Committee at the outbreak of the Civil War. The Belmonts professed Christianity, and there is today a Belmont memorial called the Oriental Chapel in the new Cathedral of St. John the Divine on Morningside Heights.
Hmm.
Birth name was Schoenberg, by the way. And Wikipedia says exactly the same as what the International Jew here says, so this is not even controversial.
Yeah, that Schoenberg, that was the name, not Belmont. So they took the name Belmont.
Yeah.
That's so common. And they pick the names. I might have that in my notes as we get down further. I'll wait for then. Okay.
Rothschild power, as it was once known, has been so broadened by the entry of other banking families into governmental finance that it must now be known not by the name of one family of Jews, but by the name of the race. Thus, it is spoken of as international Jewish finance, and its principal figures are described as international Jewish financiers. Much of the veil of secrecy which contributed so greatly to the Rothschild power has been stripped away. War finance has been labeled for all time as blood money, and the mysterious magic surrounding large transactions between governments and individuals, by which individual controllers of large wealth were made the real rulers of the people, has been largely stripped away and the plain facts disclosed.
Yeah, and this is what needs to be done with all these things. Oh, like the Holohawks. I always want to say Holohawks for some reason anymore. The Holohawks and so on. You know, the mysterious, the mystery and the magic and so on, and the religious symbolism and so on needs to be stripped away and the plain facts disclosed. That's what we need to do with everything.
Yeah. Well, I would say that the real rulers of the people today are the owners of and controllers of mass media.
There you go. I would too. There's nothing, you know, I mean, it all depends on what they do. So you know who's in charge of mass media.
Yeah. The Rothschild method still holds good, however, in that Jewish institutions are affiliated with their racial institutions in all foreign countries. There are Jewish banking firms in New York whose connections with firms in Frankfurt, Hamburg, and Dresden, as well as in London and Paris, can be traced by the mere matter of signs over the doors. They are one. As a leading student of financial affairs puts it, the world of high finance is largely a Jewish world because of the Jewish financiers, quote, absence from national or patriotic illusions.
Yeah, I've got that in big type. You know, and that brings up what you've been talking about the last couple of shows, or certainly last week you mentioned it a couple of times, about how these Jews do what they do because they don't identify with the community.
That's right.
You know, so they can just rip people off because it's not, they don't see that, they don't see Americans as their community.
Yeah, terrible. And if you have a political ideology that allows people to be opportunistic and to be profiteers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is basically what Reaganism is, sorry to say, then the Jews can just have a field day because have no conscience about taking advantage of that.
No, they don't. And that's exactly what we do have. And we celebrate this idea that what the people should be, if people can make money, it almost absolves them of any guilt or any wrongdoing in the eyes of the people because, oh, they're so smart. And the International Jew has mentioned that several times.
Right.
You know, how we say, oh, aren't they clever? Oh, yeah, they're doing some bad things, but, oh, aren't they smart and clever? Almost like that makes up for it. It's okay. You have to admire them.
Yeah. Well, if you're rich, you're a good man. Okay. That's plutocracy.
Okay.
To the international Jewish financier, the ups and downs of war and peace between nations are but the changes of the world's financial market. And as frequently the movement of stocks is manipulated for purposes of market strategy, so sometimes international relations are effected for mere financial gain. It is known that the recent Great War was postponed several times at the behest of international financiers. If it broke out too soon, it would not involve the states which the international financiers wished to involve. Therefore, the masters of gold, that is, the international masters, were compelled several times to check the martial enthusiasm which their own propaganda had aroused. It is probably quite true, as the Jewish press alleges, that there has been discovered a Rothschild letter dated 1911 and urging the Kaiser against war. The year 1911 was too early. There was no such insistence in 1914. Not only do these foreign financial affiliations cast a different light on purely national matters affecting the peace and prestige of those peoples, but they tend toward an extra or supernationality. When these foreign affiliations enable Jewish bankers to excel in the more highly specialized forms of finance, such as foreign exchange, they also enable them to exercise almost complete control over international money movements.
Yeah, and you know, the idea that money is international is something that they've convinced us of so much. And that if we didn't have, you know, international trade and free trade and all this stuff, we would all be so much poorer. You know, we wouldn't have all the goods we have and the economies wouldn't work out. And they try to show that when anybody is isolationist or something, that they just suffer for it. You know, that's part of the whole thing that's been going on just about my whole life, but yeah, mainly since the 80s.
They really made it hard for the Third Reich to get foreign currency. And the way that they dealt with it was by barter, international barter. They would would trade goods for goods internationally. And that's how they circumvented the fact that the Jews controlled the international currency exchange.
Right.
I remember reading about one instance where Standard Oil was paid with Hohner harmonicas.
Huh.
There is no question whatever of international Jewish finance being deeply concerned in the matters of war and revolution. This is never denied as to the past, but it is just as true of the present. The League Against Napoleon, for example, was Jewish. Its headquarters were in Holland. When Napoleon invaded Holland, the headquarters were moved to Frankfurt on the Main. It is remarkable how many of the international Jewish financiers have come out of Frankfurt. The Rothschilds, the Schiffs, the Spires, to name but a few. The racial affiliations running all through the world of international finance are readily recognized.
Well, you know, I want to mention here before I forget. Oh, I think this is what I have a note down later. It comes up again. The name, the Spires. You know, these Spires came from Frankfurt area, and some of these people, they came from. Well, there's a Spire. There's a town of Spire, very old, very historic.
Yeah, took the name from that.
They took the name, just like I was saying a while back. Who else took the name? The Warburgs. The Warburg family ran away from Italy, where they were being chased out or something, and they went to Germany, and they went to this, settled in the town of Warburg, and they took the name Warburg, changed their name. So then the same with the Spires, so that they appear to be, you know, German. And so people say, oh, these are Jewish Germans or German Jews. Well, they're not German. They never were German. They came from somewhere. And it just irritates me. The same with that Belmont taking that name. Okay.
Well, who was the first Jewish Supreme Court justice?
Well, which one was he?
Well, wait, no, that's not the first one. Anyway, Felix Frankfurter. I think he was the second one.
Yeah, he was one, though. There's another one, Frankfurter. Where, you know, right. I'm glad you brought that up.
But, yeah.
Those aren't Jewish names.
People who have German cities as surnames usually are Jews. At least in this country, they are. The name is Berlin or
yes,
Frankfurt or Hamburg.
Yes, that's right. They take that. You're right. It's not surprising that you don't have some Jews named New York.
The racial affiliations running all through the world of international finance are readily recognized. These associations produce in Jewish banking circles a constant tendency toward control or monopoly of certain lines of industry which are identified with the fields of finance. The rule is, once control is gained, all non-Jewish interests must be driven out. Jewish financial interests have rarely been connected with industrials, says the Jewish Encyclopedia, except as regards some of the precious stones and metals, the Rothschilds controlling mercury, Barnathel Brothers and Werner, Bite and Company diamonds, and the firms of Lewison Brothers and Guggenheim Sons controlling copper, and to some extent silver. Close quote. To this, of course, may be added whiskey, wireless, theaters, the European press, and part of the American, and a number of other fields. The list will be made complete in this series of articles before they are finished. The Jewish Encyclopedia continues, It is, however, mainly in the direction of foreign loans that there has been any definite predominance of Jewish financiers, this being due, as before stated, to the international relations of the larger Jewish firms. And this, of course, means that the Jews are also well-situated to take advantage of what we've been forced to accept as the so-called global economy, because they've got all those international connections.
Yes, right. That's why they want a global economy, because they're already set up to run it and take advantage of it.
Yeah. People that only have relatives within a particular country can't really benefit from that.
That's right.
In order that the senseless denials of certain portions of the Jewish press may be checked, it may be said that Jewish authorities do not deny such statements as are made about Jewish international financial control, although they declare it is not as strong as it once was. Of more recent years, says the Jewish Encyclopedia, non-Jewish financiers have learned the same cosmopolitan method, and on the whole, the control is now rather less than more in Jewish hands than formerly. This is true, at least so far as the United States is concerned. Previous to the war, the status of many of the Jewish financial concerns in Wall Street was stronger than it is now. The war brought about a condition which threw a new light on the internationalism of Jewish finance. During the years of American neutrality, I think he means neutrality before the U.S. entry into the war, but after the war started. During the years of American neutrality, there was opportunity to observe the extent of the foreign affiliations of certain men, and also the extent to which ordinary national loyalty was subordinated to the business of international finance. The war really forced a coalition of Gentile capital on one side of the struggle, as against certain blocks of Jewish capital which were willing to play both sides. The old Rothschild maxim, "Do not put all your eggs in one basket," becomes perfectly plain when transposed into national and international terms. Jewish finance treats political parties the same, bets on them both, and so never loses. In the same way, Jewish finance never loses a war. Being on both sides, it cannot miss the winning side, and its terms of peace are sufficient to cover all advances to the side that lost. This was the significance of the great swarming of Jews at the peace conference. Many of the Jewish houses on Wall Street were originally the American branches of long-established houses in Germany and Austria.
Why do so many of these bankers, they come from Germany and Austria? Because they were the best bankers? Or that they were already Jewish? How did these Jews get so well established in finance and banking in Germany and Austria? Is there any answer to that?
He mentioned that there were some of them were in the Netherlands and fled to Frankfurt.
Yes, that's true. I guess they had good conditions there for them. That's the only answer to that.
Well, maybe some of them also went to Vienna from the Netherlands.
Yeah, well, Vienna was a very popular place, and it has always been very Judaized and still is.
So then Napoleon would be the reason why they were there. These international firms were accustomed to support one another with capital and maintained other intimate associations. Some of them are linked by intermarriage. But the bond above all is the Jewish racial bond. Most of these houses received a severe setback during the war, First World War, because their overseas associations were not of the right kind. But this setback is expected to be only temporary, and the Jewish financiers will again be ready to give battle for the entire financial control of the United States. Whether they will be successful, the future will decide. But a strange fatality seems to follow all forms of Jewish supremacy. Just as the capstone is ready to be placed upon the edifice of Jewish triumphs, something occurs, and the structure shrinks. It occurs so often in Jewish history that the Jews themselves have been exercised to find an explanation. In many cases, anti-Semitism offers the readiest excuse, but not always. Just at the present time, when the light which was shed by the fires of war was revealed has revealed so many matters formerly hidden in shadow, the awakening of world attention is called anti-Semitism, and the explanation is given that after every war, the Jew becomes the scapegoat. A curious admission which would lead a less self-centered people to inquire why. But so handy and so untrustworthy an explanation as anti-Semitism does not account for the failure of Jewish financial interests to become absolutely dominant in a country like the United States. Anti-Semitism among the people does not surge high enough to injure those securely entrenched behind great financial influence. The silent resistance of the Wall Street Financial Group or of the New York Stock Exchange, for example, is not anti-Semitism. It is not a hindrance to the Jews in doing business. It is opposition to an apparent program for total control, which is sought not for the general good but for a racial benefit.
Yeah, Jews, the first racists, huh? Wouldn't you say? They've always been racists.
Well,
now Judaism, I'm not against racism, but
it's fundamentally a tribal religion. They don't want anyone to marry outside of their tribe. If they were not already a mixed race, we would say that it was a racial religion. It's still, you can say that it's a kind of racial religion.
Well, they're racist in the sense that that word is used today, and they were all the way back then.
Yeah.
Because you're supposed to want to just allow people to marry whoever they want. Mm-hmm. You know, mixed races are good.
It was only a few years ago that the banking house of Kuhn, Loeb & Company was commonly regarded as being destined in the near future to win complete financial supremacy in Wall Street as an underwriting and money lending institution. There were many reasons for this belief, among them the fact that Kuhn, Loeb & Company were the financial backers of Harriman in his terrific railroad duel with James J. Hill. But the prophecy regarding this financial institution was never realized. Untoward events intervened, in no way affecting the financial integrity of the firm, but bringing it into the light of undesirable publicity, not of a financial character.
Well, they don't specify what that is.
Yeah, I don't know. They had strippers at the party or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
In the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, Jewish finance in the United States reached its high watermark. The head of this firm was the late Jacob Schiff, who was born in Frankfurt on the Main and whose father was one of the Rothschilds' brokers. One of Jacob Schiff's associates, Otto Kahn, was born in Mannheim and was early associated with the Spires, who also originated in Frankfurt on the Main. Another associate, Felix Warburg, married into Jacob Schiff's family. Jewish finance has spread, but it has not risen higher than this firm.
And they've all taken their names from the towns that they went to live in that weren't their hometowns or anything. And then even the Rothschilds took their name from the sign they put over their door.
Yeah.
There's something sneaky in, where they're trying to fit in somewhere where they don't really belong, and they're hiding their origins. That's what they're doing.
Well, yeah, they try to appear patriotic or whatever.
Appear like they fit and they belong there.
A flank movement, however, has been attempted, which may bring Jewish ambitions nearer the goal of their desire. Checked in Wall Street, Jewish financiers have sought out other American centers and even foreign centers whose future influence on American affairs promises to be considerable. The first flank movement is toward Central and South America. It may be said that the financial assistance, practical and advisory, offered to Mexico during the most unsatisfactory period of her relations with the United States was given by her Jewish financial groups. The attempt to gain influence with Japan seems to have come off rather badly. It is known, of course, that Jacob Schiff gave material assistance to Japan in the war with Russia. This was explainable on the ground of good business and also of a desire to revenge Russia's treatment of the Jews. Mr. Schiff used the opportunity also to instill the principles, which have since grown up into Bolshevism, into the minds of Russian prisoners in Japanese war camps. But more than that, the idea appears to have been to add the newly rising Japanese power to the string of Jewish financial conquests. Jewish finance already has a foothold in Japan, but it appears that Mr. Schiff's hopes in this respect were not fully realized. The Japanese are credited with knowing much more about the Jewish peril than even the United States does, and they were exceedingly wary. They kept the business deal strictly a business deal, and Mr. Schiff was said to have been displeased with Japan generally. This is well worth knowing at this time, especially in view of the propaganda which seeks constantly to cause misunderstandings to arise between the United States and the Empire of Japan. Now, that's how many years before Pearl Harbor? 20 years, roughly?
Yeah.
So eventually they managed to get a war started, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, well, as they say, you know, as they said last week, they think in terms of, and somebody said they think in terms of, what was it? Anyway, hundreds of years, you know, they take the long view and they know they're eventually gonna accomplish what they're trying to accomplish.
But South America appears to be the latest objective. It must be remembered that the Jews exercise world control in two departments, in movements of men and in movements of money. No government, no church, no school of thought could order the movement of 250,000, half a million, or even a million people from one part of the world to another, shifting them as a general shifts his army. But the Jews can do that. They're doing it now. It is only a matter of ships. From Poland, where Jewish special privileges have been written into the law of the land by the all-powerful peace conference, and where it would seem that the Jews have every reason to remain, there is a great movement westward. It is not a stampede, as the American Commissioner of Immigration says, although it may look so from this side. It is an orderly movement, as can be seen when the American Jewish directors on the other side are observed. And part of it is being directed to South America. It is said that after a period of training in the United States, some of the immigrants who are now landing here will be shipped south again.
Yeah, now here's, you know, here again is one of the worst things that ever happened was when all these Polish Jews were somehow sent to the West, you know, and we're moving into the West. And then they say during World War II that 3 million Polish Jews were slaughtered. You know, no, that's not true at all. Well, we can't get into that right now. But, I mean, this is just a little background here that is part of the explanation for what happened to the Polish Jews, who were really mostly really Russian Jews. I don't want to blame Poland.
They're probably Jewy Jews,
yeah. Well, yeah. The real Jews out of Russia.
Yiddish-speaking Jews.
Yeah, right.
The other mastery which the Jews exert in a world degree is that over the movement of gold. Without giving expression to what the purpose may be, there is this to be said. A large movement of Jewish men and Jewish gold proceeds toward South America these days. And there is said to be a large movement of other materials, which, when interpreted by the protocols can mean but one thing. Dun dun dun. What would that be?
Well,
what would be this other material?
Other materials. Can be, I don't know. I wasn't really. I wasn't
pornographic really magazines, maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
Just kidding.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. The next attempt for control of the Americans may come from the South, where the Jews are already stronger than their numbers would indicate, and where their revolutionary proclivities have already come into play as between the various states. These rebuffs and these strategic flank movements do not, however, complete the record. We are now speaking of American finance only. The Jews have not been restrained elsewhere as they have been in Wall Street. They exercise a very ominous control in a number of other fields, each of which will be taken up in detail in due time.
Mm-hmm. For the present, where the media will come in, one of them.
For the present, our attention is being directed to New York and its financial district. We have just shown the high watermark of Jewish control as it has been reached up to date in the street. Capital S, street, that's Wall Street. There is another aspect of Jewish influence on the financial affairs of America which is not so flattering to that race. If Jewish financial activity does not go higher, it goes lower and finds its way into darker channels than does any other form of financial activity in the country. It would make a sordid tale, the operations of the Robins, the Lamars, the Arnsteins, and the others who have contributed to the long roll of criminality produced within the shadow of Wall Street. And the only point that could be served by its retelling is that such criminality is predominantly Jewish. This is not to say that it has the approval of the Jewish community, but it is very significant that while whole volumes of abuse have been heaped upon the Dearborn Independents' very modest effort to state the status of the Jewish question in America, the leaders of Jewry have been silent about the criminal financial operations of those who could be made to feel the displeasure of their race. The Jewish passion for the defense of the race, regardless of the degree of guilt, is well known to every prosecuting attorney. Although it must be said that during the investigation made some years ago, which revealed the business of commercialized vice to be under Jewish control, certain public-spirited Jews commendably aided the work. This aid, however, did not prevent the severest opposition to certain publications which gave notice of the facts which the investigators were finding. So some Jews were willing to help.
Well, yeah, because it made them look
but
bad.
They didn't want the public to know.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it made them look bad, you know. And yeah. When it gets that bad, vice and so on. But you're right. They don't want.
The country was lately astounded by the revelation that stocks and liberty bonds, that's bonds from the First World War, to the value of $12 million. Had been lost through a systematic series of thefts in Wall Street. Beginning with the spring of 1918, messengers sent out by the New York Stock Exchange firms to make deliveries of stocks and bonds to other houses in the course of ordinary business began to disappear as if the earth had swallowed them up. For a time, these disappearances were without explanation. Wall Street is really a small district. Most of its business is done within the space of a city block. Messengers on their trips sometimes went only to another floor in the same building, or to an office across the street. Yet in those short trips they would disappear, with all their securities, seldom to be heard of again. Up to the summer of 1918, the absconding messenger boy was a rarity. The type was regarded with good-humored indulgence on the street. They were generally happy-go-lucky youngsters, and the steadier heads among them graduated into clerks in the commission houses. The labor shortage struck Wall Street, along with other sections of the country, and messenger boys were difficult to find. During this period, there was also a great expansion in business. Nearly everyone in the country possessed bonds of some kind, and these changed hands in unparalleled quantities. On the floor of the stock exchange, daily transactions in bonds up to $20 million and in stocks up to 1 or 2 million shares were common. Following the sales, the stocks and bonds were transferred from seller to buyer by a messenger boy. It was not unusual for irresponsible lads to be running from office to office in Wall Street with $250,000 under each under their arms. Then, with the shortage of boys, another type of messenger began to appear. And with this type, the trouble began. Disappearances and losses became more frequent and costly. The indemnities paid by the insurance companies reached such staggering figures that the custom of issuing blanket insurance was withdrawn. Various expedients were adopted to solve the mystery. Boys were required to travel in pairs. Guards were posted throughout Wall Street. The best detectives in the land were assigned to the matter, but without avail. There was a strong disinclination in Wall Street toward publishing the figure of the losses for fear the publication might be destructive of public confidence in the street's financial condition. But the news was known in the underworld and drew to New York criminals from all parts of the country. For a time, all efforts were fruitless. The losses continued and the mystery deepened. Then suddenly, in the early part of 1920, certain arrests were made and confessions obtained, which disclosed one of the most amazing criminal conspiracies in the history of the United States. There was proved the existence of a vast Jewish conspiracy to loot Wall Street. It was found that a band of astute Jewish criminals, many of them wealthy men, some of them ex-convicts, had created an organization by which Wall Street financial houses were to be plundered.
Yeah, Jewish mafia. You know? So here we have this real criminals, and now these same kind of people run the government.
Bands of young Jews, mostly of Russian origin and living on the East Side, had been shaped into being. These lads, instructed by clever Jewish principals, applied to Wall Street messenger agencies for employment in brokerage houses. It was part of the plan for them to assume good, honest-sounding Anglo-Saxon names. The cover name, how often we meet it. These lads turned over their stolen stocks and bonds to the heads of their organizations, who in turn passed the securities on to the Jewish principals, who were, for the most part, members of the criminal band of confidence men in the White Light District, the bankroll men, whose immunity from punishment has always been one of the standing puzzles of Gentiles residing in New York. That White Light District, I believe, is what they now call Broadway.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
The entertainment district on Broadway. Mm-hmm. These Jewish criminals were aided by Jewish lawyers in their transactions. The stolen stocks and bonds were taken to Cleveland, Boston, Washington, Philadelphia, and parts of Canada, where they were pledged as collateral for loans in an apparently legitimate course of business. One of the messenger boys refused to deliver his stolen securities for the small sum he was offered for them, and ran away to enjoy alone his ill-gotten wealth. His hiding place was discovered, and members of a band of Harlem assassins were sent for him. Harlem used to be Jewish, by the way.
Oh, I was thinking they were using black people.
No.
When did Harlem become black?
Around 1930.
Well, we're talking about 1918. Oh, 1930. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. From about 1870 to 1930, there was a significant Jewish presence in Harlem.
All righty. Well, what kind of a place was it? Was it still kind of a low-down kind of...
I don't know.
Must have been, where the low-life lived.
I don't know, but some of the Black Baptist churches in Harlem were originally synagogues. His hiding place was discovered, and members of a band of Harlem assassins were sent for him, with instructions to find where the securities were. If they were on the boy's person, he was to be killed at once. This band entertained the boy with drinks and women for several days until they learned that the securities were sewed inside the lining of his coat. They took him for a joyride into the country, and his dead body was afterward found, typically slain, with about 24 dagger wounds in his body. In one instance, a non-Jew was inveigled into the nefarious scheme, and the method was also typical. The Jewish principals wished for another clearinghouse through which to dispose of their securities, and were tipped off that a young non-Jewish broker was on the verge of bankruptcy. He was helped out and given what appeared to him to be a very profitable piece of business. Once in the power of his friends, and deeply entangled in their game, he tried to get out of it. He was threatened with death. The Jewish principal said to him, "I don't want any double-crossing here, or I'll kill you in a minute. If I can't do it, if I'm locked up, there are plenty of my gang who will do it." Upon the arrest and confession of this non-Jew, many of the Jewish principals fled New York, traveling, as usual, under their assumed Christian names. But their identity had at last become known, and although many of their messenger boy dupes have been made to suffer the penalty for their crimes, the leaders are, at this writing, yet free, and the most powerful influences seem to be invoked to protect them from the ordinary operations of the law. A few have been captured, but although their accusers are the most powerful banking, brokerage, and surety companies on Wall Street, a power greater still seems to defend them from the treatment usually accorded to known criminals. One of the ringleaders has defied the courts with impunity and still walks the streets. One of the ringleaders. Jewish theatrical managers in New York have headlined his actress wife, a Jewess, presumably because of the added prestige it gave her to be the wife of the world-defying bond thief.
Well, now, so they know who this is, but they're not telling us. Oh, why don't they put his name in here?
Well,
really. So they're protecting the Jews.
I suppose it's a hassle to be sued even if you win in the end. That is the element which strikes something like consternation to the heart of the ordinary lover of law and order. The insolence with which these wealthy Jewish criminals regard all the agencies of the law. They are defended by clever lawyers, and the attitude of the Jewish press and Jewish population toward them is compact of sympathy and admiration. Why not, since most of the individual victims of the thievery are Gentiles? And the general victim is Gentile capitalism itself. There is complete silence on the Jewish side regarding this reign of crime, and yet inevitably the Jews themselves must suffer most from it. The New York Kehillah has completely ignored this outbreak and its exposure. The spokesmen of Jewry, so voluble against non-Jews, have no word to say about those whom they would probably call their co-religionists. Yet it is well enough understood that so closely combined are all the influences in New York Jewry that a determined effort on the part of the leaders could clean up many untoward conditions now existing. But there seems to be a distinct aversion to anything that will indicate a division of one class of Jews against another. It is a racial instinct, evidently, to protect the threatened one, no matter how richly he may deserve punishment. It is this fact which puts the finishing Jewish touch on the whole matter. It may, of course, be an accident that all the criminals and their tools, with an occasional exception, are Jews. That of itself might not be a reason in the extreme sense for labeling the condition with a racial name, but the silence, the approbation in some quarters, the very active sympathy in others, all combining as a racial protectorate around the wrongdoers, is the more regrettable manifestation of the two.
Well, you know, that's the end of that chapter. Wow, we make good time when we don't do a whole lot of talking, when I keep quiet. You know, we've still got 10 minutes, Hattie.
Yeah.
So we can invite someone to call in if they would like to. You know, we don't have any extra time on this program, but if anybody would like to call in and comment on the show or on what we talked about tonight, you can do so at 1-830-443-4911, because we still have 9 minutes to go. I don't think we'll probably get a call, but, you know, I would be very happy if somebody would call. I'll get my Skype page up here and take it. So, well, you have any comments about this chapter, Hattie?
Well, that section where it says, a strange fatality seems to follow all forms of Jewish supremacy. Just as the capstone is ready to be placed upon the edifice of Jewish triumphs, something occurs and the structure shrinks. You know, that's an interesting observation. When the Jews seem to be on top of the world, that's when you can expect them to have a big setback.
Yeah. Well, you really think that happens? I don't know. People seem to like to say that.
Well,
I'd like to believe that, but I'm not so sure.
Reasons that you could give for that. For one thing, parasitism and governing are not the same skill at all.
Well, yeah, okay.
That's... A parasite relies on somebody else to maintain a little bit of order and to produce things. You can't have... How can a parasite live without somebody else producing? You can't... The parasite needs the host, right?
Yes. Well, use the example of Israel. They've been in charge of Israel for quite a while. And, of course, they've been in charge of New York, and they've been in charge of the United States, too, for quite a while. But still, they're parasites there. How is Israel doing? Most people say that it's a failed nation. It's a failed proposition if it wasn't for all the support that the money they get. So yes. They're still parasiting on the U.S., on Germany, on lots of some others, too. So they get all this help. Otherwise, they would succumb.
Well, they've really shown their hand in the last few years. A lot of people are aware of Jewish power now and are ready to discuss it, who would not have discussed it before September 11th, 2001. Mm-hmm. It's pretty obvious now. And meanwhile, they're also destroying the United States. The huge amount of money that the United States spends.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how many trillions are due to the United States' support of Israel, but you can chalk up the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, the huge military that the United States maintains in pursuit of what they called the Wolfowitz Doctrine, plus all the foreign aid that's sent to Middle Eastern countries and Israel. Because we're paying those Arabs basically to keep peace with the Jews.
Yeah, that's right.
All of that can be chalked up to support for Israel, and it is a reflection of Jewish power. It is a way in which the Jews are destroying the United States financially.
Well, they are. And now, you know, I just don't see how there can be so many people who would go along with this. I mean, how powerful can Jews get anyway? I mean, is it really power? Have they convinced a lot of people that it just... stupid people that even though they're senators and congressmen and so on, they're still stupid, that this is some kind of a moral cause or something? You think people really believe that? I know there's ordinary citizens who seem to believe it, but they're always being fed that with the media. I don't know. I just find it hard to understand how people can continue to go along with such stupidity in the face of what you just explained, these trillions and trillions of trillions of dollars we're in debt and so on.
Well, it's a combination of venality and fear. And to tell you the truth, the kind of electoral system that we have, the winner-take-all system, makes it very hard for an honest man to become a politician at the national level. Because you have to go through that process.
Or a courageous man.
Well, which is about the same as saying an honest man.
You're right.
You have to cater to what the party loyal want in the primaries in order to get the nomination. And then you have to be all things to all people in the general election to get as many of those votes as possible. That tends to filter out the most honest men.
No, it does. Well,
our system really pre-selects for corruptible people, the way it's set up. We're supposed to have such a wonderful system. I'm sorry, I don't agree with that anymore.
No, I don't either. And, you know, it always comes to my mind that, you know, I can remember being in grade school. I mean, upper grade school, like fifth, sixth grade and whatever. And, you know, being aware of politics, actually, and presidential election and so on, and thinking, knowing how convinced I was that democracy was the most superior form of government ever devised, and there was no question about that. And living in the United States was just the luckiest thing in the world, you know, the best country. And democracy was, you just didn't even question. And there's, I guess, still all these people who are just the way I was then. I mean, you don't question it. But it needs to be questioned, because it's not the kind we have.
Well, it was a somewhat better system when the state governments, the state legislatures still chose the senators, because the state legislatures at least could make decisions that were not based on what the mass media were telling them. They could actually know the individuals that they were putting into office. And the state legislators are much easier for the people at the local level actually to know. You know, that's a form of government that doesn't force everybody to rely so much on mass media, which is where the Jews really get their power.
Yes, and you know, they convinced us to give up state powers to the federal by making it out that state governments were so corrupt, that everything in states were so, there were all these rednecks and terrible people and, you know, biased people and so on. And so we had to bring the federal government in to straighten things out. That's how we lost all that, I would say.
Yes, and it's interesting that that change was made about the same time as Federal Reserve and all these other things, creation of the ACLU, so forth, NAACP.
Okay. Well, we're about out of time here. Do you happen to know what next week's chapter is? I don't have it up on my screen. But it's something more to do with, can you see it from where you are?
I'm looking.
Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, while he's looking, yes, we will be back next week with, and our chapter will be what?
Disraeli of America, a Jew of Superpower.
That sounds interesting. All right, I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.